Welcome to the Little Red Podcast, which brings you China from beyond the Beijing Beltway. I'm Graham Smith, and I'm joined by my co-host, Louisa Lim, former China correspondent for the BBC and NPR, now with the Centre for Advancing Journalism at Melbourne University. We're on air thanks to support from Xinhua Ruzi, the home of Made in China, a quarterly on Chinese labour, civil society and rights.
The media in China aren't so much the fourth estate as the eyes, the ears, the throat and the tongue of the party. Their role is to channel public opinion and marshal support for government policies. And that trend has been intensifying since Xi Jinping came to power at the end of 2012. In this episode, we're examining messaging in the era of Xi Jinping and how different the messaging is for domestic and foreign audiences.
Today, our guests are David Bandersky and Qian Gang from the China Media Project to talk about recent developments in Chinese media, and in particular, how the party is projecting its image. David, from the newspapers that you've been studying and reading, how is the party branding Xi Jinping?
Well, I think one important point is that, you said newspapers, and we've really seen under Xi Jinping since 2012, his reign, I think we could call it, has really corresponded with the true rise of social media platforms. I mean, WeChat came really on in 2013-14. So the messaging is happening, first of all, through a lot more diverse types of media, digital media. And I don't mean diverse in terms of the voices that they represent. Those have been more unitary, I think. But it's really a digital. And a lot of these messages are being pushed through WeChat. And there's an emergence of a lot more digital platforms like the paper, for example, in Shanghai.
And how, apart from the change in social media usage, how does it differ from the branding of the party under Hu Jintao?
Xi Jinping has obviously a much bigger profile in the Chinese media across the board, whether we talk about traditional media, party newspapers like People's Daily, or I think if we look at the commercial press in China, we'd see it as well. A lot of these official party messages are also being amplified through the commercial press, the metropolitan press. And we've heard about Xi Jinping as the core. And a lot of this discourse, I think, suggests, although we don't know a lot of the mechanics behind the scenes, we can read some from the official discourse as we see it in People's Daily, et cetera. And it does seem that he's consolidated power to a degree we haven't seen in, you know, probably two decades. So that's a big change. As soon as he came to power, we really saw him trying to project an image in you know, November, December 2012, early 2013, of the softer, more approachable kind of people's leader. And that wasn't necessarily entirely new, but you know, he was trying to emphasize that his work style, as they called it, was different, more relaxed, and also more efficient. A guy who doesn't just speak party speak, but speaks the popular language and gets things done.
So, Qian Gang, the China Media Project has done all this work tracking the mentions of specific Chinese leaders from Mao Zedong all the way up to Xi Jinping in the People's Daily. Can you tell us a bit about how much Xi Jinping has been mentioned?
We noted how often each leader appeared in the People's Daily in the 2 years after they came to power. When we compared the front pages, we found Xi Jinping was mentioned slightly more often than Mao. Of course, there are reasons. In the past, the articles were quite long, while now the articles are quite short. Because they're quite short, there are more articles on the front page. If they're long, there's only one on the front page. So it's like that. By that metric, in the first 2 years since coming to power, Xi Jinping's rate of mention is higher than Mao Zedong's. This attracted a lot of attention. And if you add all the mentions in all versions of all papers together, higher than Jiang Zemin or Hu Jintao.
So why has there been so much written about Xi Jinping? I mean, could we even say that it looks like a personality cult?
It would need more research to say whether this is a personality cult. You can't just come to a conclusion, because it's not clear whether many mentions equates to a personality cult. Mao Zedong's personality cult was concentrated around 1967 to 69. Afterwards, he himself was annoyed by this personality cult, but his name still appeared an awful lot. That was because he was very important. He had to issue all his opinions, and other people mentioned his name.
Thinking about this expanded profile, if you think back a couple of years, the trend then was to call Xi Jinping Xi Dada or Daddy Xi. And we were even seeing videos produced by Xinhua that glorified him, like this one starring foreign students in China.
Very humble leader.
Of our Chinese leader.
Wise and resolute president.
A high and respected person.
Not only a businessman, he's also a family man.
Always smile in the public.
Very nice manner. And he's very well educated.
Handsome. Yeah, he's super charismatic.
Gentleman. His face was a little bit cute. Like everybody looks at him and they just like him.
They also refer to him as Winnie the Pooh.
At that time, it did seem as if there was some kind of personality cult being created. I mean, what was going on?
Afterwards, the name Xi Dada couldn't be mentioned. Now the People's Daily doesn't carry the name Xi Dada.
Why is that?
I don't know. I'm in Hong Kong, so I don't know why. But it's definitely like Chairman Mao, who was, for a time, the great leader, the great teacher, the great comrade, and the great helmsman. Afterwards, Chairman Mao told Edgar Snow he was fed up with this, and he only wanted to be called teacher, and so it was over. That's old history. Now the term Xi Dada is no more. It's not used in the People's Daily.
So when you're thinking about these kind of slogans, I mean, what kind of function do they play in the official media today? Why are they still necessary?
These basic political systems haven't changed. Throughout the Chinese Communist Party's history, it has utilized these systems. Propaganda is extremely, extremely important. Its basic Leninist function is to use propaganda to mobilize. So the slogans are extremely important. It's a big difference between communist and non-communist countries. In non-communist countries, it's difficult to grasp the established usages of language. In communist countries, there are established usages. The slogans are very sensitive. What you can say and what you can't say, how formulations are changed after a period of time, all of these are governed by rules. So the slogans are extremely, extremely important. You know, in China today, among all the slogans, which one is the hottest right now? That's also clear. One belt, one road. One belt, one road is boiling hot.
If you look at it in terms of the Chinese equivalent of this hardcore Kremlinology, each Chinese leader has a kind of banner term that characterizes the main planks of their thinking. I mean, do we yet know what Xi Jinping's banner term will be? And does it really make any difference if it's Xi Jinping theory or Xi Jinping thought or something else like Xi Jinping's governing concepts?
It will have his name and then a big word. The biggest word is ism. In Chinese, even Chairman Mao didn't use this. After ism is thought, then after thought is theory. Now, in different media, the term Xi Jinping theory is appearing. The Hong Kong media are using Xi Jinping thought. So that appears to be the scope. Xi Jinping plus either theory or thought.
I mean, in terms of the kind of fine distinctions, what's the difference between theory and thought?
The most powerful is thought. If after the meeting Xi Jinping thought emerges, then we know he's reached the pinnacle of power. The others are weaker than this. Theory, concept and strategy are all weaker.
But it seems as if Xi Jinping has concentrated more power than Hu Jintao or Jiang Zemin did. So can't he decide himself whether his thinking is a concept or an ism or a thought or a theory or whatever?
I don't know. But you can turn it around and see what his thinking is defined as, and then from that extrapolate how powerful he is. If it's an ism, then he's more powerful than Chairman Mao, and that's impossible. A thought would be the next most powerful level, and everything else would be below that.
So when it comes to the situation of journalists in China, I mean, we've seen a real attempt to ramp up control over journalism. There's been a whole raft of new exams, a whole raft of new legislation. and requirements, including this exam on the Marxist role of journalists. I mean, how do we see the effects of that playing out on journalism in China today?
Well, with the exam systems have been, you know, this Marxist view of journalism has been around, of course, for quite some time. And it's basically about how the role of journalists is defined. And it includes things like a repudiation of Western ideals of journalism. So when you see the flag sort of go up on this rhetoric of the Marxist view of journalism, you often see a corresponding, a matching uptick in rhetoric attacking freedom of expression. We've seen that almost routinely now, you know, editorials in the People's Daily that will look at Trump and Clinton, you know, contest last year and criticize the way the press in America has covered it and talk about exposing the way the lie of freedom of the press in the West. So we see these periodically come up. I mean, they came up through the 90s. And each time this happens, it's really about sending a signal. So rarely is it ever about the substance of the training. You know, it kind of makes us think when we hear about a training session that everyone has sat down and they're told that this is your role as a journalist and you report this way and you don't report this way. And there is that aspect of training. But the primary role, I think, is still fear. And it's a reminding journalists that you work for the party, for no one else. You don't work for the people, you know, the public. You work for the party. It's interesting that, you know, we had the media policy in China, the control of the media, the term that we have used since June 4th, 1989, the crackdown on democracy demonstrations in Beijing and elsewhere in China, was guidance of public opinion. And they still use this as kind of the term that encompasses the idea of media control. After this crackdown in 1989, we saw a resurgence for a number of years. There was a lot of talk, if you go back and look at the party's own internal discussion, about party spirit. There are a lot of these abstract terms when you deal with the press policy. You have to understand this kind of nuanced language. And the dangxing or party nature was a debate, and it's actually very old. Even going back, if you look before the anti-rightist movement in the 1950s, it's basically a debate about who the press serves. Does it serve the people or does it serve the party? There's the dangxing and renmingxing. And an editor of the People's Daily in the 1980s, in this, when the spirit of reform was gripping China, talked about the emphasis on the people's nature. The media serve the people. And this is the editor of People's Daily, remember? And so there was this debate. Now, after Tiananmen, this debate was reinvigorated, but it was very one-sided. There was no doubt, again, that it's the party nature that's supreme. The media serves the party, full stop. So interestingly, we've seen this under Xi Jinping as well. The party nature, the dangxing, and again, being surnamed party, has come back. But we don't have the trauma. I mean, we have to ask, what is the trauma that has created this situation? We know what it is with June 4th. It's a loss, as they see it, of control over the media and a whole new policy to address this loss of control. Well, this return now to party nature makes us think, well, what are they responding to? And if we need candidates, we could say, well, 2010, 11, 9, you know, maybe the Arab Spring and the rise of social media, you know, maybe that's one candidate. But it's kind of interesting. We have antibodies without a clear disease. You know, we don't know exactly what they're afraid of.
And there are other terms from post-89 that are also reemerging in the party discourse as well, like historical nihilism as well as another good candidate, right?
Yeah. And we've had, most recently at the NPC this year, we had this introduction of a new regulation on history. And basically makes it a slander to suggest that historical figures, you know, like Lei Feng, that everyone knows these are invented party mythology, you know, about heroes sacrificing their lives, et cetera. And they're all mythologized. But to suggest in a publication, for example, that these histories are false, or to correct the history in some way as a historian would be now defamation.
For a long time, media scholars were making the argument that the kind of market forces were driving reform of the media, that, you know, people wanted news that was outside the news dictated by the party, and that would mean a better sort of a more varied news diet for Chinese consumers. Does that still hold true today in Xi Jinping's China?
I guess I'm, you know, guilty as charged, because I've written for you know, over 10 years about the commercial press, you know, the Dushi Leibao, as they're called, the metropolitan newspapers. And, you know, I think they really there were dramatic changes, you know, from the end of the 1990s through to 2010-11. Still, we were seeing a press that could be quite feisty. And maybe one of the most important things is that under this trend of commercialization and the complexity of China, you know, entering the WTO, becoming more integrated with the global community, a lot of different factors, people becoming savvier, the media developed professionally, definitely up to 2008, they started to have quite a strong reputation. A lot of these publications, Southern Weekly, Southern Metropolis Daily, the Beijing News, you know, there's a lot, Cai Jing, now Cai Xin. But the reputation, unfortunately, of journalism now, I think, is failing. So there was a time when it was kind of a golden era to be a journalist and even to be an investigative reporter. So there are a lot of reasons why this is changing. One, of course, is Xi Jinping and its control. But a lot is also the pain that we've seen in the West, you know, media under transition into a new digital era. That's also really hitting Chinese media. So in a way, it's kind of a perfect storm, I think, we're seeing now, where you have a loss of culture that was centered at these commercial magazines and newspapers. This professional community is kind of falling apart. It has to be remade on the digital side. But at the same time, we have these political factors coming in that mean they're going to do everything they can, they being the party, to ensure that as these seeds kind of develop, they control it. And that's why we're seeing a lot of development on the party side. It's as though we're seeing the birth almost of a new party system. You think about the party papers of the past that controlled public opinion, and then this commercial, these commercial offshoots. They're almost taking the opportunity to have a digital rebirth of a party-controlled system.
Well, one possible side effect of this is the changing nature of who is a journalist. There was one survey in 2016, I think, that showed that 80% of journalists were born after 1985, meaning they're less than 30 years old. Some coverage of this year's National People's Congress suggested that the young Chinese journos were mostly interested in taking selfies in the Great Hall of the People. Is this lack of experience a problem? And do these younger generation of journalists have a different approach? And where have all the older journalists gone?
Yeah, I'll pick up on the end. We've all heard about Alibaba and Tencent and a lot of these big, you know, internet giants and the whole e-commerce revolution in China. So I think a lot of them who have stayed, you know, even sort of remotely in the media have been picked up and gone to places like Tencent and Alibaba, which just have much deeper pockets and can pay better. And that's always been a problem for Chinese media and being attractive. I mean, pay has really not gone up in the last, you know, 15, 20 years for Chinese journalists, and that makes it difficult. A lot of them still work by, you know, publish or perish rules. You know, you get paid by the column inch, you know, and that's difficult. There's another reason for the kind of corruption of the system as well. When journalists aren't paid well, it's very enticing for a journalist, if you're going to get paid for publishing, to take a kind of press release, you know, from a company with your red envelope and then, you know, publish that in your newspaper or whatnot. But it's difficult to make a living as a journalist. And if you're approaching journalism with some idealism that you want to be a professional and you want to make a difference, and there are some like that who are determined, but then you're facing an environment where it's costly. It's costly on a personal level, and it's also costly for the media. You can't invest in real news reporting or in-depth coverage or explanatory coverage or investigative coverage when that takes time and resources, and you don't have any guarantee that once you've done that, in fact, you're practically guaranteed now if you do that, that that's wasted. And think of the way even a new outlet, like I mentioned, The Paper in Shanghai, and The Paper did quite, I think they spent about 6 months doing a really in-depth kind of investigative series on the Three Gorges Dam, which is, you know, environmentally damaging, costly. There are a lot of things to discuss with the history and the presence now of the Three Gorges Dam and its impact. But that was killed within, I think, 7 hours. So, I mean, it's discouraging on all sides, you know, in terms of practicing journalism. I think my colleague Chen Gang compared kind of what happens in Chinese media to, you know, imagine you prune a tree and it starts to grow in a different direction. And if it gets, you know, more brutal than that, you might even cut down the tree and then mushrooms start to, you know, bloom at its base. And that's kind of what we see. We see in Chinese media that it's always developing in some way around its traumas. And we see that now with things like creative nonfiction. You have a lot more young people in China interested in expressing themselves. They're enamored with Peter Hessler and this kind of writing. And, you know, that can be personal, memoirish stuff that doesn't get into the heavy issues, but sometimes it does in interesting ways.
Although it does seem to be a rather depressing countervailing sentiment that the only space left for any kind of independent thinking is soft profiles.
Yes. No, I think that's totally valid. Aside from, you know, journalism news or daily news or in-depth coverage, we have in the recent times had interesting publications like Yanhuang Chunqiu for you know, a kind of party-linked journal run by more reform-minded people within, many of them sort of party insiders, that cover Chinese history and current affairs in fascinating ways. And Yanhuang Chunqiu basically suffered a hostile takeover in the last year or so. So they're non-existent now as the what we once knew as Yanhuang Chunqiu.
And Yanhuang Chunqiu was also so well known because of the fact that those behind it were so well connected, but even they have not been able to continue.
Yes, and there are media, and I won't even mention the media, specific ones, but there are media that are some of the strongest we have now, and there's reason to worry about what's going to happen ahead of the 19th Party Congress. You know, when you have shifts in the leadership picture, you know, people leaving the Politburo Standing Committee that may not be champions of press freedom, but maybe defenders in another way of certain publications, able in some cases to go to bat for them. We are worried. What's the situation going to look like after, you know, November for them?
In the past, when I've done research in rural Anhui, the only time we came across what you would call the mainstream press was when they were out to shake people down. So how the scam worked was basically you would have an incident, so say involving land being illegally claimed from some farmers, and they would then report this. The press would get wind of it and would arrive en masse and take detailed notes, even film what had happened. And then immediately as they had their material, they would go straight to the township or county government offices and say, how much are you willing to pay us to stop this going out? Interestingly, TV stations were able to command the largest amount of money, whereas print journalists you know, only got a small cut. Has this kind of behavior been stamped out by Xi Jinping's anti-corruption drive? And is this, to be cynical, partly why people are leaving the profession, because this kind of money is no longer there for the taking?
It's very difficult to get a clear picture. It always has been of news extortion, that kind of, or media corruption, and what you just described would be called news extortion. And it's actually quite common. We've rarely seen cases of it. There have been a few. I mean, at one point, China Central Television ran a series and looked at local newspaper that had done this and had people on camera. It didn't surface that much. And then we had one of the most famous cases was one of our fellows at China Media Project, Liu Chang. He was for China Youth Daily. And he arrived at the scene of a mining disaster. I think some 13, 14 people had died in this incident and then been stuffed into a mine shaft, hidden away from their family members. And it was 3 days later, I think, that he finally arrived. And Xinhua News Agency reporters had been there, and a number of local, as you said, local newspapers and television crews. And he eventually learned that they had accepted cash and gold nuggets. So this was called the gold nugget case eventually. And he won a news prize for that coverage. And he got a lot of flack for that from some journalists, as though he wasn't standing up for others in his profession. You know, it was a lack of sort of professional camaraderie or whatever you would call it. But it was a rare case of that kind of behavior being reported on. But we had an expert, it was just last year, who came to the center and was interested in exactly this issue of media corruption and painted a picture that was even bleaker than I would have thought, you know, having written about this phenomenon 10 years ago or so. Often commercialism is in the media is blamed for this, you know, the changes that were ushered in the mid-90s. But of course, every time you see it happen, as you said, the television crews are often the most successful, and the state media are far more successful than anyone else because they have power behind them. If you're from Xinhua or CCTV, no one is going to say no to you. They fear you and they pay you in direct proportion to that fear. So control of the media is also an important part of the story of this media corruption. And that's not changed. And the only way I think we could have the media stamping this out is if media were empowered to be watching each other, to have that kind of professional cross-checking, and that just doesn't happen.
It was so interesting what you were saying before about the birth of a new party system, which is kind of playing out through social media. And one thing that anyone who's on social media might have noticed recently has been this massive publicity push for the One Belt, One Road project, China's massive infrastructure project, so the kind of new Silk Road thing. There's just been this large number of publicity videos that have been released in kind of quick succession, each worse than the last. I think we do have an example of a particularly terrible music video which shares the catchy lyrics, extensive consultation, joint contribution, and shared benefits.
Baby. Extensive consultation, joint contribution, and shared benefits.
I mean, it really is unforgettably bad.
I don't even think I can pronounce that. Extensive consultation. What was the other? It's hard even to say in my own language.
But I mean, who is this messaging designed for?
In many ways, this is new in terms of the media that they're attempting. This is an old story in a way for Chinese mainstream media, by which we mean party state media, to get out China's message, to convey China's view, China's voice. And that's important to hear that that's not China's voices, it's China's voice. It's a unitary voice. So it's been experimenting with these forms and talking internally about how to get its message across for many years. And I think in the last few years, we've seen a lot more experimentation with these videos, animation. Xi Jinping has appeared in sort of cartoon form, which is again about making him approachable and sort of real and hip and relatable.
Thinking about getting the message out and getting the message beyond China's borders, apart from keeping terrible rap artists in work, the Belt and Road Initiative is presented as a way to bring much-needed infrastructure to China's neighbours. But apart from roads and belts, it seems they're also exporting telecommunications. So are companies like Baidu using this opportunity, this deep well of funding, to export China's model of cybersecurity to their less democratically minded neighbors?
There's no doubt that one of the big trends under Xi Jinping, one thing he's done, you know, in terms of the internet or cyberspace, he's created this cyberspace leading group. He's the head of this new party level committee, this kind of super agency, and under it is the Cyberspace Administration of China, the CAC, and it administers all of these cyberspace issues, including issues increasingly, you know, and going into the future about e-commerce and all these kind of mobile-based media initiatives and the sort of digital economy and all of this. So we see cyberspace and the internet moving really, really to a central position in China. And we also have seen under this a push for this notion of cyber sovereignty or internet sovereignty. And China has really pushed this, the Communist Party has really pushed this as a theoretical innovation. And you can read its own discourse. It talks about it very clearly in this way, as though this is a gift to humankind. We had this notion arising in the West, or so goes the narrative, of sovereignty, national sovereignty, borders, etc. But China has innovated this concept of sovereignty, and now we can talk about the internet and cyberspace as also having borders. And this is perfect because it wants to legitimize its own controls, even though we know that the internet's very difficult for this, right? And as a borderless space in some sense. And it wants to be able to talk about its policies at home and repression at home without apologizing. I think the leaders are now in a position of confidence. The internet was always something that very insecure about, but I think we're seeing a new sense of confidence from Xi Jinping and the rest of the leadership that we can have our cake and eat it too. We can have an internet that is controlled but still vibrant and innovative. You know, we can do it. We can nail Jell-O to the wall, or we can mold Jell-O is probably a better way to see how they understand the internet.
And one thing I noticed from the late noughties and even before is that creative fiction was another way to get critical messages out. If you think about Wardu on housing affordability, or Don't Talk to Strangers, on domestic violence, and more recently, Towards the Republic, which used the words of Sun Yat-sen to critique the late Hu Jintao regime. Rather than banning soap operas, which of course they did when they crossed the line, apart from the ones on time travel, Xi seems to have learnt that these can be a very useful vehicle for the regime to get their message out. And if we think of a recent soap opera, In the Name of the People, which is a sexed-up propaganda piece about Xi Jinping's anti-corruption drive, it's a huge ratings phenomenon. Is this a new way the regime gets its message out? And is this where a lot of journalists have gone to?
I think it is. I think, at least in terms of forms and maybe in terms of production value, then there has been a definite change. And this is because of there have definitely been changes over the last 20 years in media education. I almost called it journalism education, but I think when we're talking about mainland China, it's difficult to call it that often. But there are more and more Chinese who are being trained in terms of, filmmaking and editing and post-production, you name it. So there is a new savviness, just as many Chinese have become more savvy in how they consume media and what interests them. I think that there's a lot more interest and maybe a lot more know-how on the production side. But again, I would say that they're hobbled, by these restrictions, these political restrictions. And it's also true of publishing, whether it's e-publishing or print publishing. Just imagine that one of our guests did translate a Harvard book on writing stories about creative nonfiction, and it was a nightmare to get that published. This is just knowledge from Western writers of creative nonfiction translated into Chinese, but that association with Western writers, et cetera, in this kind of environment is extremely sensitive, even though it has nothing to do with current affairs in China. The environment is just so tight that I think it's very difficult for China to take advantage of all that that creative capacity that it does have.
I mean, I wanted to ask about this new move towards soft power projection overseas. At the end of last year, the 31st of December last year, China launched CGTN, China Global Television Network, which is a new kind of rebranded CCTV.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
So, I mean, the last time that we saw one of these big pushes, I think it was in 2009 when CCTV was opening bureaus across Africa and America. I mean, why is this happening now? Is it something to do with the 19th Party Congress, or why would they bother to have this kind of rebranding at this point in time?
That's a really good question. I think the 19th Party Congress is something so internal that really the internal messaging of it is the big issue. And they're very careful in the messaging around the 19th Party Congress. My guess is it's not linked to that. With the 19th Party Congress, we look at little nuances, about leaders. For example, we just did analysis of the People's Daily in April and noticed that Wang Qishan, who's the anti-corruption chief, missing entirely from coverage in the People's Daily. It's a fascinating little detail.
For the whole month.
Not once.
He's on the way out.
Which means that he's on the way out. So we can look at this little signaling, and these are the things that are sort of carefully negotiated and that we look for ahead of the 19th. I think the international push is always there as this kind of mantra, and we'll see it again mentioned in the 19th Party Congress political report, and we'll maybe see soft power again, et cetera. My feeling is that a lot of these things are just driven by budget. There are a lot of people who are getting their pockets lined, you know, at the likes of China Central Television and these outfits to do these things, do these makeovers and create apps. You know, when I saw the CGTN and I looked at the coverage, there was nothing that seemed to me to be new or hip. So there, I mean, in a way, you can see the party is playing a very difficult game, which is why it's really eager as much as it can to push to have a lot of this internet development happen on the state side, you know, through People's Daily and China Central Television. And now they're talking about, what do they call it? It's called a hub, I think, in English, but in Chinese, it's like they call it a kitchen, you know, chufang. And the idea is to have this centrally produced, a kind of news agency for the new era that's producing multimedia content that can be used by different news products on things like WeChat and news products, but it's more centrally produced. So they're trying to find ways to control, I think, a lot of this digital growth.
What you're actually talking about is the digital transformation of the propaganda apparatus, isn't it? This idea that the party control is being transferred into new digital spaces and the whole chufang, the kitchen, is cooking up this message in a unitary way, but propagating it across all media.
Yes. I mean, it ties into a lot of notions like innovation, for example. You'd be mistaken if you think that innovation is something like what we mean when we're talking about Silicon Valley. Innovation in a Chinese context, in a party context, is also about innovating control. Because, of course, that's their vision, is that you can innovate, you can attract, you can create a product that is controlled even quite strictly in political terms, and its impact is managed, and yet people love to use it, and it drives sort of a digital economy. This is what they want. It's the holy grail. So it's about technological change. It's about change in the habits of Chinese, but it's also about changes in institutions. The media were typically controlled in the past through the Central Propaganda Department of the CCP, and now they're going to be controlled primarily, I think, in the next 5 to 10 years through the CAC, which I mentioned before, the Cyberspace Administration of China, directly under Xi Jinping. The propaganda department is going to start to fade and fight for its relevance within the system. And this is a huge change. We can't underestimate this because think about the birth of the internet in China in 97, 98, when it came in. It was managed through the Information Office of the State Council, which is the external propaganda apparatus in China, where the China Daily English language newspaper is published by the Information Office of the State Council because it's meant for foreigners and propagating China's message outside China. So the internet was there because it was something that was foreign. It was foreigners, Western. It was feared for that reason. So now we have Xi Jinping with his new agency, super agency, controlling all information eventually, because all information will be digital in your hand through your mobile and whatever next products come along. And they're quite confident.
Thanks to our guest, David Bandersky, and to my co-host, Louisa Lim. I'm Graham Smith, and you've been listening to The Little Red Podcast, bringing you China from beyond the Beijing Beltway. Find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. You'll also find show notes on Facebook to learn more about the China Media Project's work. This episode was recorded in Horwood Studios at the University of Melbourne by Gavin Naber, with generous support from Xinhua Zi. Head to their website to find mismatched shards of China, including essays, original artwork, and of course, our podcast. Our theme music is by Susie Wilkins, and our cartoons and GIFs are courtesy of Seb Danta. Bye for now.